Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org.
So I don't know about you all, but in my social circles, I heard no end of how crappy 2016 was and how anxious people are about the new political order. Now it's 2017 and time for resolutions, and the whole vibe of this moment has me thinking about action. So here's my question. What are you resolved to do to improve your community in 2017? Call in and let me know, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And let's be clear, I'm not asking about improving yourself, as important as that is. I know that's what most New Year's resolutions are typically about, giving up sugar or booze or calling your mother. But do those things, yes. But in this moment here, I want to hear about your contribution to community. However you define that, your family, your block, your city, your state, your nation, your identity group, whatever it is, what are you putting in this year? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And here with me on the phone is my friend and colleague, Mark Winston Griffith. Mark runs the Brooklyn Movement Center in Bed-Stuy and has spent the past, decades putting in for Central Brooklyn, from improving banking to food access to public safety. And I think you even ran for city council, Mark. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Great to be here with you, Kai.
Glad to have you. So it's 2017. You have kind of already done your part for community over these years, as I just got through ticking off. But still, as a model for listeners, what are you thinking about? What are you going to do to contribute to community in 2017?
Well, I think that what I'm thinking about is very similar to what you just said at the top of the hour, and what I think a lot of my colleagues are thinking. That is, you know, with the recent election, we have seen something that organizers actually look for, which is for their issues to be polarized, for there to be no doubt about what the stakes are, for things to be dramatized in such a way that their constituents, that the people they work with, understand what the challenges are. And so I think with this recent election, on so many different issue fronts, and I just think in the world of social justice in general, people now understand that the forces that they've been working against are lined up against them in a way that they've really never experienced in their lifetime. And so for me, as well as for other people, I think it's in some ways it's somewhat simple. It's a lot of the work that we do, if you've been committed to social justice, then a lot of the work that you do in some ways will remain the same. It's just going to be a lot harder. We're going to have to work harder. We're going to have to focus. And I think that more importantly, we're going to have to reach across lines, reach across issue lines and constituent lines. And, you know, when you work in the world of social justice and you're a nonprofit, you oftentimes get put in these very specific lanes, what people call silos. And so I think what we understand, and I think what a lot of my colleagues understand, is that we have to break free of those silos. We have to support one another across those different lanes, and just recommit ourselves to the work that we've been doing for all this time.
So I'm often asked, Mark, by people, you know, where do I start? So people who are not professional activists, professional organizers, people who haven't been engaged in community, however they define that, and they say, I'm no activist. Where do I begin? Right. Where do I actually start? How do you answer that question?
Well, I think you start with what you care about. There are issues, obviously, that hit you, that hit not only your self-interest, but the interest of your family, of the people around you, the things that you care about. So you start there and you identify what those issues are, and you think about also what you're good at, what's your skill set. And then you just try to line that up with things that currently exist. I would not suggest that people go out and start a new organization, right? I mean, as you said, if you're not an activist, if you don't do social justice in some ways professionally, there's no reason to start now. You can rest assured that whatever it is that you care about, there is an organization, whether it's local, whether it's statewide and regional, whether it's national. There is an organization that is doing that work. And so find out about that organization. You know, if they have a membership like ours, you can join the organization. And so in the case of an organization like ours that has a membership, you don't just become a supporter. You don't just become a spectator. You actually get involved in the day-to-day activities of the organization. You help to strategize. You put yourself on the front line, and you put yourself in communication and community with other people who feel like you. And you will realize that there will be no shortage of work to do, and that you will be called upon in short order, you know, probably before the week is out, to get involved in one way or another.
I want to go to Mitch in Brooklyn, who has been getting involved and has a unique way he's been doing it. He's been taking something he's already doing and putting it to use as a sort of new organizer, right? Mitch, tell me about what you're doing.
Hey there, Kai. So I run a small press known as Inpatient, and it started off as kind of saying to publish my friends who are such great artists, and then eventually it became this bigger thing. And so we've always kind of been a soapbox, you know, for people who with unheard voices. And now I think we're trying to be more politically engaged and actionable than ever. Right after the election, we've actually been holding some events at this place called the Sunview LunchNet, which is in Greenpoint on Nassau Ave. And we've been raising money. We've been using it to, like, hold poetry readings and raise money for Planned Parenthood and Sister Song, which is an amazing reproductive justice organization. And so we're really just recommitting ourselves and to this resolve to find, you know, the kind of voice in the wilderness that's crying out in it. Platform.
I think I lost you there for a second, Mitch, but I apologize for that. So it was a poetry press in the first instance, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It began as a poetry press, and then as we built it up, we wanted to, you know, become more engaged and be less, you know, aesthetic and more just actionable, more politically involved. Work in March. There's this amazing writer, Heather Johnson, and she's running a survival guide for being, you know, a queer youth of color in America. And I think that's just, it just blew me away when she read some poems at this event we held in November right after the election.
And how's that felt? How's that felt for you and the folks in the group? Has it been exhausting? Has it been innovating?
It's been exhausting in the way that it's the best. You know, when you're doing work and you feel tired, but you wake up and you have that resolve every morning. That's kind of, it's the exhaustion from actually working and doing something, you know. And and it can be overwhelming, but it really is a lot of fun. And you know, after the election, everyone was so dour. And I remember all the readers that we had booked for this reading. And they were all kind of down and like, should we even do this reading? Like, what does it mean to be doing poetry after Trump? And we all said, you know, we're going to do it. And we went there and it was just, you know, we had all the solidarity. It was so beautiful. And everyone cried together and read and laughed. And it was amazing. And it was like, this is why I do the press. And my New Year's resolution is to do that more often.
You laugh, you cry, you change the world.
Yeah, I try.
Thank you, Mitch. Olivia in Brooklyn.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. How are you? What are you up to in 2017?
Okay, so my commitment for the past 3 years has been being a Girl Scout troop leader. I'm part of the Girl Scouts of Greater New York organization. And right after the elections, of course, I was devastated, but I decided to make my resolve and make a stronger commitment to continue volunteering and leading these girls and teaching them to be strong, powerful women. And that's my commitment to them. And I would say to anyone who's interested in volunteering for either as a Girl Scout troop leader, there's over, I think, 29,000 girls who are looking to join troops. and get involved. And we have a shortage of leadership of people that volunteer their time to meet with these girls, whether it's going to be on a weekly basis or on a monthly basis, to teach them life skills and to do really cool and interesting stuff, you know, to bring them happiness.
And what was your first step, Olivia? How did you get started on
this?
My
first step was I'm a parent, so I have three little girls, and I wanted to have them join the Girl Scouts, and I found a troop out in Ditmas Park, Brooklyn. I was looking for diversity, and that's what I got for my girls. And the first step is going on the Girl Scout of Greater New York website, and it tells they have tabs for parents, for girls, and you can look into the organization and then decide to sign up and then find the troop. There's different ways of joining. You don't have to do a weekly meeting. You can join and participate in events that they hold, and I think that's a great way to give back and to continue, giving back to the community.
Great. Thank you for that contribution, Olivia. I'm going to go to Martin in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Martin, what are you up to in 2017?
I'm an active member of the Unitarian Society in Ridgewood, but I've also been on a town committee for 7 years. And what I've come to understand, having moved to a town like Ridgewood, which has about 30,000 people, excellent schools and whatnot, is, and like a lot of places, that the market is basically gentrifying elders out of our community. Elders are being driven not only out of, New York City, but also a lot of communities in New Jersey where the taxes keep getting raised to pay for the schools. And so I'm specifically been advocating for over 55 housing, but I'm seeing a really generalized problem in our generation, which is that a lot of people are part of the sandwich generation, but we in Ridgewood and a lot of towns, and even in the Upper West Side, we see way more strollers than wheelchairs. And I think that is a huge community issue that hasn't been addressed and that I'm really putting a lot of passion into.
Martin, I like that you're looking around at your community. What's happening literally around you and trying to respond to that?
Well, and I think I hope that other people can look around their communities too, because it's not only where I live. The market is driving the aging industrial complex that ships all our elders out to cornfields, Pennsylvania.
Well, thank you, Martin, for your contribution in 2017. I'm going to go to Amy in Madison, New Jersey. Amy.
Hi, Kai. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have three things, actually, that I'm going to be doing this year. The first is to give a small amount of money, $25 every month, to an organization that I know can assist our local communities. I'm most interested in food justice issues. I'm giving to an organization called Grow It Green and also America's Grow-A-Row. Also homelessness, so I'll be giving a donation to Homeless Solutions and also the environment with the work that the Great Swamp Watershed Association has been doing. So I can give a small amount each month throughout the year. The second thing I'm doing is I'm putting up a note that I'm going to keep close by with the name of my representative, Rodney Frelinghuysen, and also the two senators, Cory Booker and Robert Menendez, and put their contact information up. So I'm able to, when I see something that I want to respond to or voice an opinion on, I'm able to do it. Because so many times I say, oh, I should write my senator, I should do that, and I don't have the contact information. And then the third thing is I work at Drew University, where I work with students who are called civic scholars, and they're students on scholarship who are committed to community. And they do about 100 hours of volunteer work every year in addition to other things. And so I'm going to be motivating them and encouraging them to affect change in their community and know that they can make a difference. So those are my three resolutions.
You've got a long list there, Amy. I love it. You're going to put your money where your mouth is, put your telephone where your mouth is. This is great.
It's small steps, taking small steps throughout the year, not one big thing, but it's hopefully going to affect our community. Mm-hmm. And I'll, do my very small part to help make a difference.
Thank you for that, Amy. Mark, small steps, particularly on financing. I like that Amy's talking about she's just going to put $25 a month into local nonprofits. I feel like a lot of us feel like, well, if I'm going to be a donor to something, I have to donate thousands of dollars. That's not true, right? Or is it true? I don't know. How do you feel about it, having run
absolutely.
All of these organizations?
Giving money is donating, contributing is just one is a very simple thing that everyone can do. And when I say everyone, I mean that even if you're on a very limited income, barely have any income, just sharing a tiny piece of that not only makes a big difference, but I think that many people are under illusion that it's foundations and big institutions that are keeping charities and advocacy groups and organizations like I was organizing, community organizing, social justice groups alive. But in fact, it's individuals who give the vast majority of those monies. Even when we talk about things like churches, you know, and you think of tithing, it's the work of the individual member of the congregation that is actually keeping that institution alive. And so I think that's a really strong lesson to take from this, that you may not think it's a lot, but whomever you're giving to will probably think differently about that. And if there are enough people like you who are giving a little bit, then you can keep an organization alive that way.
Yeah. I am Kai Wright. I'm an editor at The Nation magazine, sitting in for Brian Lehrer today. We're talking about your 2017 resolutions, not to improve yourself, that's important, but to improve your community. What are you going to put in? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's go to Muriel in the Financial District. Hi, Muriel.
Hi. Thank you so much for letting me talk about this project. I make American flags that celebrate diversity, and I have since 2003 as a response to the flag being used as an instrument to promote war, which I feel as an immigrant, it's not about that. It's about e pluribus unum, about out of many one, coming together to create a beautiful country that works in unity. So I'm stepping it up. I'm making a 60-foot by 40-foot flag. I'm inviting people to send me cloth that represents their culture, whether it's from Uzbekistan or India or England like me, to include in this mosaic of different people to open the conversation about what it means, what our motto means, which is on our money. It's an important motto. And I think we've gotten away from it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing.
It puts me in mind of the AIDS quilt, Muriel, and this the community effort to sort of stitch together a project that celebrated the lives of everybody that had passed from HIV back in the day.
I think I'm inspired by that. Yeah, I feel that I don't want to say, you know, you're wrong about how you do this or that. What I want to do is take an art project and make it something that we can use as a conversation piece to talk about what we're doing that's right, how we are living together, how people love this country and why they or their family came here and what they're doing and what they brought from their country that is of great value to this culture. That's what the whole project is about. So if I might just say, my website is murielstockdale.com, and they can contact me if people want to participate in this project.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Muriel. Mark, Muriel, we had Mitch, my partner, are all artists who are looking for ways to show up with their art in some way. What role can artists play in community organizing in over your years of doing this work?
We've just heard perfect examples of it. You know, being creative in general is a excellent way of supporting. That is, people, whether it's things that can be used to raise funds, whether the art in itself helps someone look at an issue in a fresh and different way, or just whether it's a matter of getting creative people and people who are not ordinarily as politically active, getting them involved and interwoven into the fabric of social justice work and of community change work, then in and of itself can make a profound impact. So, you know, when I was talking earlier about sort of crossing lines, that's exactly what needs to happen, because we oftentimes think of ourselves in these very specific ways. We have these identities, whether we be artists, whether we work on Wall Street, you know, whether we're advocates. And what I think this moment does is give us an opportunity to think of how we can leverage what we have, you know, and our creativity and our talents, and put that to use to leverage them for a bigger cause than ourselves.
Let's go to Bob in Yonkers, New York. Hello, Bob.
Good morning. I'm a volunteer with a bunch of high school students in a school here in Yonkers. Most of the kids in the class are undocumented, I would suspect. And I want them to be aware of globalization and geography. And, you know, globalization is a 13-letter word, but the middle letter, the seventh letter, is the letter I. And I want them to know that they, although they're in the middle of this word, they and people like them are what makes this world go round. So one of the things I have the kids do is write down on a list all the clothing they make and where it's made, and then go to the map and find out where it comes from. Because what I say to them, globalization is like a foreign term, yet it's closer to them than if they were in that country, because it is literally on their body. It's the shoes, it's the underwear, it's the shirts they wear, and where they're made. And then to have the kids go to a map of the world and find out where their descendants came from. And just last week, I had 10 kids in a room. One child knew where his grandparents came from. It was Laos. I had kids in a room from South America, Honduras, Guatemala. They weren't even sure where South America was on the map. So my goal this year is to make kids aware of where they are in this world relative to the rest of the world. I tell them that of the 20 people in this world who are living today, only one lives in the United States. And yet we have a tendency to think that the world revolves around us. And to some extent it does. But for them to realize they're just part of a much greater, large world where everybody is like them. They breed, they get hungry, they get tired. But because we're so lucky in this country, we take it for granted.
There is an I in globalization. I like that, Bob. Remind me, how old are the kids you're working with?
The ones I'm working with are 16, 17, are high school seniors and juniors.
Got it. Well, thank you for that input in 2017, Bob. Let's go to Sam in Brooklyn. Sam.
Hi. So I'm also working with kids, but in a slightly younger age group. I'm working with my daughter's preschool in Brooklyn in Fort Greene, Clinton Hill. It's called Bija. And we're doing two different things. The first is that we've been holding a drive for Syrian refugee families that are being relocated in the state. We've had our kids, who are all under 4 years old, go out and purchase new toys and also go through their own books and toys to collect things for kids that are arriving in our country with nothing. The second part of what we've been doing with her school is through a nonprofit called the Bija Fund, which is raising money for kids in our neighborhood that couldn't afford the awesome, progressive Brooklyn preschool that, you know, our kids are fortunate enough to go to, and we're raising money so that they can get free or low-cost tuition. Because I really just feel like, you know, starting social action when you're as small as possible is what helped inspire me now as a 35-year-old woman to be out doing things, and, you know, is a good example that my parents set and that I want to pass on to my kids.
Wonderful. Thank you, Sam, for that contribution. Mark, let's finish up with talking about some of the challenges that we have here when you want to go show up. One of them is, I guess, burning out, right? You know, I mean, I think that I talked about at the beginning of this segment that I know so many people who have been complaining about how they have felt at the end of 2016. But I also know a lot of people who have raced into the gap and started getting to work and may already be getting tired. How do you deal with balance and engaging in a way that doesn't burn you out?
Well, it's a really good question. And at the end of last year, after the elections, you you saw that people had sort of taken, many people had taken a really deep and profound body blow and were demoralized. And I think were left a little, not only confused, but just really exhausted because, you know, as we know, the political season was not only exhausting physically, but just mentally and spiritually. I mean, it was overwhelming. And so I think one thing you have to do is just give people a moment to rest and to restore themselves and to heal. And so much of the work that we do is focused on that, understanding that you can't always sort of, you know, externalize your energy. You have to maintain that there has to be a certain level of self-care that you as a person does, but that you have to model for an entire community. And so we have done a lot of that. And at the end of last year, after the election, we held a big sort of event where we just fed people and we talked. And there was a little bit of strategy going on. But the whole idea was just to be in community with other people. You know, there was some Reiki that we did, some dance healing. And so that you have to weave into the work. But I will tell you right now that now we're in January, people are ready to go. And that's the energy. I think that, you know, having come off the holidays, people have done that they've rested and they've meditated on this, and now I think people are ready to go in 2017.
Mark Winston Griffith of the Brooklyn Movement Center, thanks for helping us talk this through.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And let me wrap up with my own resolution. I'm going to show up for affordable housing in my neighborhood. That's important to me. I'm going to get the nerve up to help organize a block association, and I am, in fact, going to call my mom more. So. Speaking of Governor Cuomo's moves to the left, over the holidays, he commuted the 75-year prison sentence of Judith Clark. Clark was involved in an infamous 1981 heist of a Brinks armored car in Rockland, New York, in which two police officers and a security guard were killed. Clark and the others involved in the heist considered it a political act. They were acquiring funds for an offshoot group of the Weather Underground. But her case has become a rallying point for a more recent political debate, sentencing reform. At 67 years old, she's in the 36th year of her sentence. By all accounts, she has been a model of personal reform, which is the nominal purpose of our prison system. Even the former superintendent of the prison where she is held has argued that it's time for Clark to get out, to no avail until now. Cuomo cut her sentence to 35 years to life and thus made her eligible for parole. She'll face a hearing later this year, a fact that some celebrate and others find detestable. But, and this is our interest today, before the governor took notice, Judith Clark's story also caught the attention of Harriet Walker, who, among other things, is amongst the greatest Shakespearean actors alive. Next week, Walter will begin a run of Shakespeare's The Tempest at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn. It comes to us from the stages of the Dunmar Warehouse in London. And as the final installment of a trilogy of Shakespeare plays set in women's prisons and performed by all female cast. Walter leads the company, and she has based her character on Judith Clark. Harriet, thank you so much for joining us. I'm honored that you've taken time out of your no doubt hectic preparations to come.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great.
So let's start by getting us all on the same page about the productions, because this is quite a layered thing that's happening. And, you know, let me just admit something from the jump here. I don't have as firm a grasp on Shakespeare as I probably should. And so it's a bit intimidating to be speaking with a world-renowned master of his work. But I imagine at least some of our other listeners are also like, wait a minute, what's The Tempest about again? So give us the wiki version, ground us in the story. There's actually a play inside a play happening and set at a women's prison, correct?
That's right. I mean, we needed an excuse. We wanted to have an all-female cast, and it started as an excuse. Well, in a prison, you'd have to have an all-female cast. There'd be no choice. But it became much more than that, because the plays deal with deep, deep questions of of vengeance and forgiveness and crime and retribution and love and death and pain in the biggest ways possible with this giant Shakespearean mind behind it. And women in this situation are much nearer and up against these big questions than perhaps we are with all our distractions of going shopping and driving around town. These are people who have to look at their demons every day. And so it is a precedent that a lot of Shakespeare companies go into prisons, professional workers in Shakespeare go into prisons, and they bring out these wonderful performances in the prisoners, who then suddenly feel very connected to the rest of the world, and they get a sense of their own value, their own self-esteem, self-expression, and they escape for a little while from being a number and a uniform with a horrible track record. You know, so this is a precedent. It's not such a wild idea. Mm-hmm. And as far as the receptions we've had so far, this started as an experiment back in 2012. The audiences we've had have been younger than usual, more mixed in ethnic origin than usual, and so many people who've never even touched Shakespeare, never been to him, never heard of him, or done, you know, very boring versions of him at school, have come out saying, this is the most accessible I've ever had it. This, I understand it, I get it, I love it. So we feel we've really succeeded in some way in inspiring younger people.
That's amazing. By reimagining it in two ways, not just in terms of the gender of the class and the setting, but then there's also this piece. Each of the actors, as I understand it, you were all asked or chose to base your characters on an actual inmate, right?
Well, in fact, I was the only one who's chosen a true person.
Okay.
And what happens is that, you know, you choose an amalgamation of people, whoever will help you play the part you have to play. And so when we started off and I was to play Brutus in Julius Caesar, who is a very tortured, politically motivated, educated person of deep moral conflict, I was looking around on the internet for somebody of my age, and I'm the same age as Judy Clark, give or take a year, who might have been involved in some political activity that would have ended them up in prison. And that was exactly what I was Googling, and so I Googled Judy Clark into my life.
And that was the first you'd heard of her?
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
And I read a profile of her, and I found out a bit more about her, and I didn't kind of copy her or imitate, you know, I'm not playing Judy Clark. In fact, my character is called Hannah Wake, but she is largely based on a similar story. Mm. And I found it very fruitful for my imagination to go in depth into a character I knew was actually living this life herself. And then I finally got to meet her and was so impressed by her that I joined the many people who've been campaigning to get her a commutation of her sentence.
What struck you about her? You said you Googled her into your life because she just kind of fit the type of prisoner you were looking for to base. But now you've met her and something deeper happened for you. What is it? What drew you to her?
Well, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, we behave badly or well, whether, you know, according to whether we're going to be rewarded or punished. Well, this is a woman who has behaved supremely well for, you know, most of her sentence now. I mean, she started off bad and mad, I'm sure, and was very difficult in the early years. I'm sure she was a furious bundle of anger. But she knew she would never get out. And if you know you're never going to get a reward, and you still reform your personality and your feelings, and you still pay the price, because she's very penitent. She does not dodge the issue and say, well, you know, I only drove the car, I didn't pull the trigger. She doesn't do any of that. She says, I was part of the organization, and as a result of this robbery, three people died, three families were left bereft, and I will never forgive myself for that. Mm. You know, so she has faced her demons more than most people, and she has faced the reality. She never knew this was going to happen, that Cuomo was going to step in. She faced the reality that she would never, ever come out of prison. She would die there. And if you know that, and you know you've got no personal reward to gain from behaving well or behaving badly, and you still decide that, you know, for my own soul and for my own internal self-belief, I want to become a better person, not because I'm going to get free or because I'm going to get a prize, but because I need to live my life better, then that really impresses me.
One of the striking facts about the case, the listeners should know who aren't familiar with it, though I imagine many people in New York already are, is, you know, she received such a long sentence, I believe more than others, any others involved in the crime, because she basically refused to mount a defense. She didn't acknowledge the legitimacy or the authority of the court at the time.
That's right.
And that's that era that you're talking about where she was really upset and then somewhere made this pivot to focus on community service instead. And that's the pivot that really inspired you.
Yes. I mean, she's a very intelligent person. And so, she's taught herself a whole lot of stuff and studied a lot of stuff and passed this on to other women. And that I related to in my character, that we sort of make out like I'm the mentor for all these younger women. And I'm trying to give them a voice by showing them what they can do through Shakespeare. And then they're going to go out into the world and live better lives and maybe kick their drug habits or, you know, kick their pimp out or whatever it is. Mm. I'm trying to empower the other women. And in a sort of parallel sense, Judy's been doing that with the women in the jail she's in.
Are there other ways that she sort of informed your performance or performed the way you constructed Helen?
Well, I'll tell you something. When the woman I met was very serene and very sweet and gentle. And I'm not playing anybody serene or sweet and gentle. I'm playing a less evolved person than the one I met, because the characters I'm playing are I have been playing Brutus and Henry IV, and now I'm playing Prospero. And Prospero goes through this journey from raging and creating this storm to parallel his inner anger. And he goes through the play. It's almost the play is an exorcism for him. It's a kind of almost a psychotherapy for him, whereby he can go through allowing his daughter to marry and leave hold of her, and to kind of come to terms with his own past and forgive his enemies and be forgiven. And it's a very beautiful play in terms of, you know, the end of someone's life cycle, becoming at peace finally right at the end. Well, you know, so there's not a lot of peace during the play. I only achieve it right at the end. And I think Judy's already arrived at that place much sooner than I have.
Or much sooner than Prospero has.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, because of the fact that it's an all-female cast, gender is front and center, at least in our minds, about this production. I want to talk about that. But first, it, in Judy's experience, thinking about long-term incarceration, for you, was there anything particularly gendered about that experience and being in prison for 36 years and having to figure out what to do with your life in the course of that?
Well, I can be rather generalized, and I expect a lot of people to shout me down, but I think that women in a community will very quickly find what they have in common and how they can bond. They may bond into rival gangs, but they will find connections, and there will be communication in a way that, as I have heard of it, in a male jail there is more opposition, standoffs, rivalry, you know. Not to say that doesn't exist in female jail, but there will be more of them, you know, particularly there are so many mothers in jail. There are so many people who have been torn away from their families. So there's a lot of mothering goes on. And I imagine, you know, that has informed my performance, that I'm more of a sort of mothering, caring, mentor character. Mm. Although I get aggressive now and then, you know. I'm not pure as the driven snow. I'm quite a sort of mobster in some ways. But I think that my impression of females in jail is that they organize themselves socially in a different way from men. Some get very isolated and very ashamed and try and harm themselves. I mean, far too many, that's true of. And, you know, for most women, I know this in England, in a British jail anyway, the statistics are incredible. There's only some tiny percentage of women in jail who are there for violent crimes. most of them are there for causes caused by mental troubles or drug addiction or poverty. These are the things that are driving the criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. And somehow those things should be sorted somewhere else and not by locking them away from their families, who then become perhaps criminalized and deprived themselves. So to me, it doesn't make much sense to lock people up for some of the crimes that they are locked up for. This is a separate issue from Judy, obviously, but the prison population in a female jail is pretty different in character, I think, than from a male jail.
Well, it's a separate issue from Judy's specific case, but in terms of the kinds of community work that she's done while behind bars, it has spoken
absolutely
to some of these
relevant
very issues.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, she works a lot with children and women with HIV, and just hands on her knowledge in a very positive way.
Talking about gender in the performance itself, I've seen you quoted previously during earlier productions in this trilogy. I've seen you say that Shakespeare had a terribly limited range when it came to imagining women. How so?
It's just sad. I mean, I suppose he was boxed into the period he was living in and his own experience of women, and that's every playwright's prerogative to write about see the world through their own eyes. He had bigger eyes than most, and that's what makes it doubly sad for me, that he didn't put a woman as a person center stage. She was always, all the women in his plays are there because they're wives, mothers, daughters, widows of the main man, so they are interesting in as much as they relate to that man. And they have the most beautiful things to say, and they have the biggest hearts and the wisest things to say. So I'm not criticizing the quality of what he writes. I'm criticizing the quantity and the range and the age range. There are very few older women in his picture. And so that was partly what motivated us to take on the male roles. And we don't even feel of them as gendered. We feel them as human beings. And, I don't think Brutus, I am a man. I think this is Brutus. This is what he wants. Prospero wants this, Prospero wants that. I don't think, this man.
Mm-hmm. Is there nonetheless something about, and I hear you, so you're not thinking of them as gendered one way or the other, but was there something about Prospero's character that surprised you once you did, to some degree, regender it, right? You talked about thinking about being more of the sort of bringing people together and the mothering aspect. Mm. Was there something about his character once you sort of thought of it in those ways that surprised you or changed?
I think what happened was because I'd done the other two and I wanted a contrast. I'd explored the very masculine already, particularly in Henry IV, and I suddenly find Prospero not to be of any gender. Mm. Prospero seems to me to be a parent, an aging person, with the same concerns as any parent and any aging person about the fact they've got to leave this life and hand it on to the next generation, and they can't control their children anymore, and they can't control the forces of nature or whatever it is that Prospero thought he could do. And so he's a very profound character who some say is Shakespeare writing about himself, giving up his art and facing his own mortality. It's a very profound play and a very profound character, which can be interpreted in so many different ways that I don't really think there is a character called Prospero who I know how to play. I just know that it's been an enormous help to filter this whole, to channel the whole thing through, whether it's Judy or Hannah or whoever this fictional female prisoner is, that connects me to Prospero because it connects me to what he needs to do, which is to resolve the knot of anger in himself and give generously to everybody else and use his power for good and reconcile himself to his own powerlessness and, a future where he's going to just, I hope this doesn't sound depressing, because I'm hoping I'm hoping very much that Judy will achieve, freedom. I really, really pray for that. But and if she does, I hope you know, she'll have 20 years of calm and beautiful life.
Yeah.
I think she's paid the price. I really do.
Well, thank you, Harriet. Harriet Walter will be leading an all-female company's production of Shakespeare's The Tempest at St. Anne's Warehouse starting next week. It runs from January 13th to February 19th. I personally can't wait to check it out. Harriet, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The first weekend of theatrical releases in 2017 arrives in just a couple of days, and with it, a whole new year in film. We can surely expect more sequels, I imagine. There's, of course, going to be Star Wars Episode 3, which I am personally excited about. And sorry, Episode 8. Yes, correct. And superheroes. Hello, Wonder Woman.
It is our sacred duty to defend the world. And it's what I'm going to do.
But there's plenty else to hear, there's plenty else to see from Hollywood this year. Here to tell us about the films to look forward to and maybe some to stay away from is Brandon Harris, contributing editor of Filmmaker Magazine, assistant professor of film at SUNY Purchase, and author of the forthcoming book, Making Rent in Bed-Stuy, which is no joke. I can tell you something about myself. And I want to open the phones right away to our listeners as well. What movies have you heard about that you're excited about in 2017? What movies have you heard about that horrify you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So, Brandon, let's start by looking back at 2016. That's a lot easier than predicting the future. What disappointed you the most in 2016? What did you expect to like and you didn't?
Oh, wow. That's such a fascinating question. Mm-hmm. I found most of the sort of bigger Hollywood blockbuster films this year to be somewhat rote. There were some surprises. Certainly the most recent Star Wars film I thought was actually stronger than the Force Awakens, which opened last year, Rogue One. But in general... you know, there were several movies by bigger auteurs on the sort of art film front that I found a little wanting. Although this was, for most critics, I think, a really landmark year, like a watershed year in a lot of ways. So.
Well, quickly, you got to name names on the ones you found wanting because, you know, it's winter season. We're going to be on our Netflix. What are we staying away from?
Well, I certainly think that I would hate to cast aspersions on certain films that are very popular in the award season. But for me, a film like Arrival was a big sort of disappointment, a film I expect a lot of and is, you know, active in the award season. Certainly some films that I think are strong films, but I don't think are necessarily would not make my list of the Academy Award nominees or certainly weren't in my top 10 in various critics polls, like Manchester by the Sea or what have you. I think you know, there's a number of films that could enter the conversation as slightly overrated. But I think what's more interesting is that the films that were, you know, somewhat overlooked in this past year that, you know, I think will resonate and live on in the future. A film like Chronic, which is a very small film, was nominated for, I believe, 3 Independent Spirit Awards, a film about a caretaker played by Tim Robbins. It was in Cannes and won Best Screenplay in Cannes a couple of years ago. That film made under $10,000, and yet it's you know, in the thick of the indie award season. So.
You wrote an article last month for the New Republic called 2016 was the year that black cinema pivoted. What do you mean?
Well, I think that in a lot of ways this was the most interesting year in black cinema in a long time. And certainly a year in which, at the beginning of 2016, there were so many complaints about the lack of representation of African-American artists amongst the award season contenders.
Oscars so white,
what have you. And what you found was this incredible groundswell of interest in Nate Parker's film, Birth of a Nation, which sold at Sundance for a record $17 million and was thrust immediately into the awards conversation long before many people saw it. And so ultimately it was interesting in that a number of really fascinating black filmmakers cropped up on the margins who, you know, I think are – perhaps, you know, more interesting as filmmakers and as voices. And that's not to say The Birth of a Nation, which is a flawed film, but a, you know, a really incendiary film and a necessary film, isn't something worthwhile and worth talking about. But it seems like so much of the conversation got sucked up by that film. And then later in the year, Moonlight, another magnificent film from the young auteur Barry Jenkins, that perhaps some people missed that. I don't think since 1991 there had been a year when there was such a fascinating crop of black filmmaking talent emerge at the same time.
Just in the sense of its breadth and...
Absolutely. And so also films set in African-American contexts that are very unusual. So for instance, a film that was – another film that was nominated for Independent Spirit Awards by Jake Mahaffey, a really terrific director. But you know, a film set in the working class African American church in Memphis, or Stella Maggie's film Gina the Joneses, which is set amongst sort of upper class West Indian women. These are worlds that you really don't see black cinema visit very often, and so it was just very exciting to see. You know,
well, along those lines, talking about 2017, you know, one of the exciting films that folks are talking about is Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck, who's coming out with I Am Not Your Negro. It's sort of a spiritual documentary of James Baldwin, really.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on the
Well, it's a fantastic film, and that film is kind of in the forefront of the award season conversation this year, which is interesting, although it's not getting a proper release until next year. Peck also has another film, a film about a young Karl Marx that's premiering in Berlin. He's a really fascinating filmmaker, and it's, you know, it's really exciting to see his work, you know, reach broader audiences here in the United States.
I saw I was lucky enough to go to a screening of I Am Not Your Negro, which he had a talk back, and he talked about, you know, the film is just Baldwin talking. It's all Baldwin's words laid over a series of images that he kind of unfurls underneath it. And just the content laid to the side, the presentation of it was so striking and unique to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a masterfully edited film. Certainly it's able to juxtapose Baldwin's relationship with the three significant civil rights figures who were slain, who he had relationships with, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and of course Medgar Evers, with contemporary concerns in a way that I think is just very deft and powerful and moving. But also, you know, I think it's a film that on paper probably shouldn't work, right? I mean, it feels like so much more like an essay when you describe it to people. But then when you watch it, it's such a sort of sensuous visual experience.
I was frankly skeptical, and I was just rapt. Yeah. So, and then we get new work from Alex Ross Perry, a movie called Golden Exits.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a series of really fascinating filmmakers who are returning to Sundance with new films, which is, of course, the festival that really sets the conversation around the movie award season, or the films that will kind of emerge from there to go on to you know, be big conversation starters. Alex Ross Perry has a new film that I was really taken with his last film that was at Sundance, Queen, and as well as his film last year, Queen of Earth. And so, you know, I just think he's a director to watch. But certainly in terms of the films that I think everyone is most looking forward to, whether it's the new project by Paul Thomas Anderson, which is his latest team up with the series of collaborators he's worked with over and over, as well as Daniel Day-Lewis, and that's set amongst the fashion industry of the 1950s, to bigger films like the Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner sequel, Blade Runner 2049. You know, I think that there's there's an embarrassment of riches, you know, waiting us in the new year.
What about I'm a little skeptical of this new Blade Runner. What do you think? Are Blade Runner fans gonna be?
You aren't taken with the trailer, kind of?
I don't know. You know, it's a lot to live up to.
Well, certainly. Although I just said that, you know, I found Arrival a little disappointing. I would say, in general, Denis Villeneuve, the director of that film, is a really remarkable filmmaker. We featured him on Filmmaker Magazine's cover a few years ago for a film called Enemy, which he did with Jake Gyllenhaal, which is a, you know, fantastic thriller, an adaptation of a Saramaga novel. His new, you know, his with each work, I think he's, you know, growing, and so I personally, I'm really looking forward to this film, and I and that's as someone who is, you know, skeptical of reboots and franchises as they can be. But
Yeah. There's some other big big movie reboot type things happening, right? There's Baywatch, the movie.
Yes, with The Rock.
Yes, with The Rock.
Is in the Baywatch reboot.
What do we think about this?
You should go check it out and let me know how it is.
You're not going to be there.
I might be there. I think I'm more likely to see The Rock in the Jumanji reboot, okay. which opens around Christmas time.
All right. So, yeah. And what about Alien Covenant? It's coming in May.
That's very exciting. Although I have to say, I mean, Ridley Scott, fantastic director in a number of respects, legendary director. But Prometheus, which came out, I believe, 5 years ago, felt in a way as if it was going to be sort of an Alien reboot. And then it fell flat for a lot of critics and audiences. Hopefully, I think that at least in the trailer, it seems like this film, which stars Danny McBride and the great indie actors Amy Simetz and Catherine Watterson, captures some of the sort of the blue collar vibe of the original Alien ship, as well as, having this sort of Ripley-esque heroine in Watterson. So, I'm curious to see what becomes of it. Yeah, I'm also skeptical.
You're also skeptical. All right, I have to bring in Joseph from Greenwich, Connecticut into the conversation here because I think he's got a movie he wants us to talk about that I'm excited to hear about.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I usually would go and try to impress you with my movie knowledge and international directors and stuff, but I have a 2.5-year-old son who's really into the Cars movies, and Cars 3 is supposed to be coming out.
Sure.
And after Cars 2, it's I think Pixar would agree as well that it was pretty miserable. I've watched it many, many times, and luckily I got my son to say that Cars 1 is a better movie. So I'm really excited. Cars 3 is supposed to be good. McQueen's, coming back, and he's later in his years, and it's more of a redemption story. So,
What else were your son's favorite movies of this year?
He hasn't seen a lot. Slowly working them in, but so we're mostly going after Disney. He just saw Thomas the Tank Engine, so now I'm stuck with that, unfortunately. But so I'm not a big fan. I'm not trying to hate, just the truth. But Cinderella, Jungle Book, which is my favorite, watch that. And he actually saw the live-action Jungle Book, which I was surprised he wasn't as scared of because I was a little freaked out. But the Alice in Wonderland, he loves the Cheshire Cat, which just also is weird to me out because that always freaked me out. But that's what he's watching right now.
And so, this question of what do parents how do parents make it through a movie with their kids is an important one. I think I spent New Year's with a 6-year-old, and
we were
trying to figure out what to watch that would keep us both him and us entertained. Anything exciting to think about?
Well, I think there's also a Tron sequel this year as well, which I thought the last one was pretty strong. I think that one thing that Hollywood does well is make movies for children. And so whether it's Cars 3 or any number of animated sequels, Wes Anderson has a new animated film that he's just announced that probably will arrive around this time next year. I'm sure there'll be plenty of offerings for the kids.
What's your single thing you're most excited about?
Oh, wow. I would say that among everything coming in the new year, I really cannot wait to see the new film by Benny and Josh Safdie, which is a fugitive movie starring Robert Pattinson called Good Time, which A24 will probably release sometime in the new year. Really fantastic filmmakers.
Excellent. Well, we will leave it there with Brandon Harris, contributing editor of Filmmaker Magazine, assistant professor of film at SUNY Purchase, and author of the forthcoming book, Making Rent in Bed-Stuy. Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.